Tonight I'm going to talk about self-blame. This was a request topic. There are many things to say about it, and I'll start with the Puritans. The Puritans really had a problem with vulnerability, and so they condemned any vital expressions of vitality, including sexuality and anger. Meanwhile, they valorized fear. You know, a good Puritan would be someone wrapped up in fear. And of course, they promoted all kinds of interpersonal virtues, you know, kindness and generosity and this sort of thing. But they also had this very strange idea of humility, where humility was essentially consistent with self-abasing and almost self-loathing. And so a good Puritan would be treating other people with tremendous kindness, but be actually quite unkind to themselves. And the thing that I find fascinating about the Puritan ethic is how powerfully it has shaped United States culture and how powerfully these values continue even in people who consciously don't give any credence to the Puritan worldview. You know, we are all kinds of, you know, there's all kinds of people who have dysfunctions around sexuality or, you know, dysfunctional relationships to anger, either not connected to anger or not sure how to express it. All sorts of people wrapped up in fear. And for many people, there's a profound difference in how well they can treat others and how well they treat themselves. And I'd say in particular, people who come to meditation groups and certainly people who hold professional jobs, I think in general, these are people who have completely internalized being kind, polite, nice to other people, you know. That's something we have in our bones, you know, and there's days that we have bad moments and then we're not proud of those bad moments. But in general, we have it in our bones that we're supposed to be nice to other people. And we're very uncomfortable when we see people treating other people in a not so nice way, you know. And so that's in our bones. And meanwhile, self-love is something that we, you know, we acknowledge in our head, yeah, I should be better at that, you know, that sort of thing. But of course, if it's only in our head and it's not visceral, it's far less powerful, you know. You might say that there are our instincts about being loving toward others, that has the power of a jet engine, you know. And our instincts about being loving to ourselves, that has the power of a tricycle. You know, and we wonder why the tricycle can't keep up with the jet engine, you know. So that's one piece of it, just the way that, you know, I have a strange kind of, you know, culturally have a kind of permission to be abusive to myself in a way that I would never dream of being abusive to another, you know. And I'll just say from the point of view of Buddhism, that's complete nonsense, you know. In other words, from the point of view of Buddhism, if I'm abusive to myself, that's absolutely as bad as being abusive to anyone else, you know. So it's, you know, Buddhism ultimately questions the whole self-other dichotomy anyway. So that is one piece playing into the dynamic of self-blame. Another piece is just the nature of blame itself. And I think it's a little easier to talk about this dynamic at first in an interpersonal context. You know, what does it mean when I blame somebody else? You know, so-and-so did something wrong. They did something bad. They made me mad. They hurt me. They made me sad, you know, and I blame them, you know. So first of all, in blame, when I get into a blame state, I'm giving my power away. I'm totally in a victim state, you know. And even that language of they made me mad, you know, I am occupying a worldview in which I'm saying essentially that that other person has causative agency over my internal states. They made me mad, you know? And so it's an incredibly unpowerful place. Now I can, you know, it might feel powerful, and certainly I can go around enlisting the support of others. You know, can you believe he did that to me? And, you know, like this sort of thing. But it actually is an incredibly disempowered place. It's a victim place. And so I'm not connected to my power. And also, when I'm really in the thick of the blame, I'm not in a place where I can hold any space for the humanity of the other person. In other words, when I'm fully in a blame state, they are purely the monster who caused me pain, you know? And I'm not able to see their humanity at all. It immediately subverts the blame dynamic if I'm able to get curious about their humanity. Wait, you know, what were they feeling? What were they trying to say? You know, that sort of thing. And of course, it completely destroys the blame dynamic if I'm able to step into my power. Forgiveness is very much a place of stepping into my power, reclaiming agency. And so forgiveness is actually a tremendously powerful, self-empowering act. And so in this, how can I say, with this perspective on how blame works, self-blame is almost this kind of virtuoso inner yoga position that we take. Among other things, it involves dissociation. Self-blame involves dissociation. There has to be the part of me that is doing the blaming and then the part of me that is blamed, you know? And so often it is ego that is doing the blaming, and in doing so is giving power away, giving power away to one's own pain. And the pain is what's being dissociated. And part of that blame also is I'm unable to acknowledge the humanity of the place that I'm blaming. You know, because that's part of the blame dynamic. Now, why do we dissociate? Well, we dissociate because of trauma. And in fact, there's this, one of the quotes on the quote sheet, very, very simple. One of the most painful and lasting legacies of trauma is self-blame. This is from Tara Brach. And so some trauma, of course, you know, there's trauma from all stages of life, but the trauma that often has the greatest impact on us is early life trauma, you know. And any trauma that we experience in the first few months of life, well, at that point, we haven't even integrated the distinction of self versus other yet, you know? And so the infant is in this place of thinking that, you know, everything in their experience is something they control. And so if they're experiencing trauma, the infant is likely to believe that it's part, you know, it's something they're doing to cause that trauma. As the child gets a little bit older, as they start to, you know, they start to move and develop motor skills, this sort of thing. Erickson talks about that stage as working on industry, working on exploring what it is to do. And often children then are mimicking their parents, you know, what, you know, you think of all the toys, you know, the play tool set or the play, you know, kitchen set or something. Children love imitating their parents, acting the way their parents act, trying to model the bigness of their parents. And of course, part of what we model all those behaviors, but we also model the ways that we were abused or shut down, you know, and we take those on. And so if there was a way that we were neglected, then we model that by neglecting that place within ourselves as we get older, you know. And so, what is the way out of this dynamic? Well, again, what subverts the dynamic of blame Two things. First of all, acknowledging vulnerability, acknowledging the humanity of the place that we're blaming. Often the place that we're blaming is precisely the place that needs the most love, that needs the most love and acceptance, you know. And also reclaiming agency, realizing, you know, there's actually tremendous agency in self-forgiving, in self-allowing, in self, in just the pure acceptance of, you know, I know I'm not perfect and I accept myself as I am. So I'm going to share the quote sheet. And there are some long quotes on this. The first quote is just from the Buddha, one of my favorite quotes from the Buddha. You can search the tenfold universe and not find a single being more worthy of loving kindness than yourself. So it just totally subverts the Puritan dynamic around that. Pema Chodron says, the first noble truth of Buddhism is that when we feel suffering, it doesn't mean something is wrong. What a relief. Finally, someone told the truth. Suffering is part of life, and we don't have to feel it's happening because we personally made the wrong move. Rachel Naomi Remen says, suffering shapes the life force, sometimes into anger, sometimes into blame and self-pity. Eventually, it may show us the wisdom of embracing and loving life. A long quote from Melody Beattie. Do you ever find yourself thinking, how could anyone possibly love me? For many of us, this is a deeply ingrained belief that can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. Thinking we are unlovable can sabotage our relationship with coworkers, friends, family members, and other loved ones. This belief can cause us to choose or stay in relationships that are less than we deserve because we don't believe we deserve better. We may become desperate and cling as if a particular person was our last chance at love. We may become defensive and push people away. We may withdraw or constantly overreact. While growing up, many of us did not receive the unconditional love we deserved. Many of us were abandoned or neglected by important people in our life. We may have concluded that the reason we weren't loved was because we were unlovable. Blaming ourselves is an understandable reaction, but an inappropriate one. If others couldn't love us or love us in ways that worked, it's not our fault. In recovery, we're learning to separate ourselves from the behavior of others. We're learning to take responsibility for our healing, regardless of the people around us. Just as we may have believed that we're not lovable, we can become skilled at practicing the belief that we are lovable. This new belief will improve the quality of our relationships. It will improve our most important relationship, our relationship with ourselves. We will be able to let others love us and become open to love and friendship we deserve. Today, help me to be aware and release any self-defeating beliefs I may have about being unlovable. Help me to begin again today to tell myself I am lovable. Help me to practice this belief until it gets into my core and manifests in my relationships. Then the Tara Brach quote, which I quoted already, but I'll read it again. One of the most painful and lasting legacies of trauma is self-blame. Colleen Hoover said, you've got to let it go. You can hold on to the hate and the love and even the bitterness, but you have to let go of the blame. Blame is what's tearing you down. And I like that. Raw feelings, there's nothing wrong with feeling feelings, but blame is a place of being stuck. With emotional abuse, insults, insinuations, criticisms, and accusations slowly eat away at the victim's self-esteem until he or she is incapable of judging the situation realistically. He or she may begin to believe there's something wrong with them or even fear they are losing their mind. They have become so beaten down that they blame themselves for the abuse. Sandra Lee Dennis says, betrayal trauma changes you. You have life-altering shock, and you are like and you are likely living with PTSD symptoms, hypervigilance, flashbacks, bewilderment, with broken trust, with the inability to cope with many situations, and with the complete shutdown of parts of your mind, including your ability to focus and regulate your emotions. Nevertheless, if you are unable to recognize the higher purpose in your pain, to forgive and forget and move on, you have clearly chosen to be addicted to your pain and must enjoy playing the victim. And the worst is, we are only too ready to agree with this assessment. Trauma victims commonly blame themselves. Blaming oneself for the shame of being a victim is recognized by trauma specialists as a defense against the extreme powerlessness we feel in the wake of a traumatic event. Self-blame continues the illusion of control, but prevents us from the necessary working through of the traumatic feelings and memories to heal and recover. Carol Lee says, I was a very lonely child, and it's funny, but the first word that comes to my head is starved. I felt starved for affection, starved of love, and I felt that it wasn't okay to ask for it. Maybe there was a sense that if I deserved it, it would be there. Maybe there must be something I'd done which meant I didn't deserve it. Marlene Steinberg says, escape from reality. In some instances, dissociation induces people to imagine that they have some kind of mastery over intractable environmental difficulties. Dissociation is often implicated in the magical thinking or self-induced trance states. This aspect of dissociation is frequently found in abuse survivors. It is not uncommon for abused children to engage in magical thinking to retain an illusion of control over the situation, believing that they cause the perpetrator to act out, for example. Hayward Bruce Ewart said, of all the hard ramifications of child abuse, the self-beliefs formed by the child reap the greatest destruction. Abuse is the most penetrating and permanent communication possible, and it always conveys to the child one or more of several messages. I cause it to happen. It's my fault because I am bad. I don't deserve any better. Elizabeth Corey said, we don't widely accept that bad things happen for uncontrollable reasons because of our fear. How could that be true? If that is true, we can't make sense of it with our cognitive brains, and that is scary. That is true, there's no way for us to control those things while in human form, and that is scary. So we search for meaning, a less scary understanding, and we usually end up assuming the victim is to blame. Dr. Azadon Brown simply said, resiliency is the body's internal response to a stressful situation. Jody Amon said quite simply, it is a strange thing we do, blaming ourselves when people hurt us, but we all do it. And Mark Caney says, the undisciplined mind confuses misfortune with mistakes.